Just a few film nerds breaking out of a rut, drooling over cinemas.
Max and Cassandra, manic pixie dream girls. This week we're chatting Elizabeth Town. What's with the hate, you cynical critics? The movie's pretty funny. The
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Measuring Flicks. I'm Max Peterson, and I'm joined today by Cassandra Kross for part two of our Manic Pixie Dream Girl series. So, Cassandra, we've been doing, this is our first ever official crossover podcast. So even though it is an episode of Measuring Flicks, it is also an episode of
Cassandra Explains It All and Drenched in Drama. So it's like a huge crossover event.
The multiverse. We're playing in the multiverse. For those of you who are just Measuring Flicks fans and have never heard Cassandra Explains It All before, if you like what we do, you'll very likely like what she does as well. It is very cool, 90s nostalgia type stuff. Some of the more modern episodes do have a little bit of a darker edge to them, but if you need some cozy stuff in this crazy year we're all living through, it's a good throwback to some feel good vibes from the 90s. All right, I have a little bit of housekeeping to do, but then we're going to dive right in because, man, I put off watching this movie for so many weeks because I was so fucking scared to watch it. But I'm really glad I did. I think today was the perfect day to watch it. I have a lot of thoughts, a lot of feelings, but first things first, let me get some Measuring Flick stuff out of the way. First, I'm working up some new artwork for the podcast and for the Patreon, for all my banners, all that stuff. There's new artwork coming. I have a new Instagram account that I just set up. It's Quill and Film Productions on Instagram. There's weird password stuff going on with the current Measuring Flicks Instagram, so I just started fresh. I set up a new one. I'm in the process of transferring all of the link tree and the bio and things like that from the old account to the new account. But if you want to follow along on social media, which I have stepped away from for like the last 2 years, I am getting back on there. It'll be Quillen Film Productions on Instagram. New artwork coming soon. All of the links and such should be live by the end of this week. So follow along there. We'll get new episode links and fun links to essays and, I don't know, movie pictures and such like. Part of why I haven't posted as regularly as normal, I have been working on a script for a short film that I'm going to be doing with. I'm almost done with that script, so I've had my head absolutely buried in it for like a month. I got stuck. I got depressed. I found my way through. I became elated. It's nearly done, so there'll be I'll post on Patreon about that if you want to follow along as I finish wrapping up all of this cool script stuff I'm doing. Well, as that goes into production or doesn't, you can follow the whole story over there. And while you're over there on Patreon, you can go and listen to the new series that I just started doing with my good buddy Connor, Chucky Gets Sucky, where we are watching all of the Child's Play movies and the entire Twilight franchise. And I gotta tell you, Cassandra, I think I saw you liked one of those posts. I was not expecting to like Twilight, but I am a fucking twihard, and I'm half embarrassed about it, but I'm half just elated.
It's just amazing. I know what you mean. I've watched every movie multiple times. I've read the books and I'm like, I know I don't genuinely like this, but I like this. Like I'm fascinated by Twilight.
That feeling right there that you just, the way you described that is kind of how I feel about today's movie though.
Oh God. There's this one, but yeah, I feel like I started by making a huge mistake because after I overendorsed this movie to you, I was like, it's the best. It's so good. You're going to love it so much. And then I rewatched it and I was like, oh, okay. this isn't as great as I remember. I love it, but okay, like objectively to like a film watcher like Max, like no, this isn't a good movie. Oh, oh my God.
I got in some fights with my film watcher friends about this today, actually. Let's introduce people to what we're talking about and we'll dive on in because wow, I went on a journey with this film today. So today we are talking about 2005's Elizabethtown.
Let me tell you about my day.
You're about to lose this company. $972 million.
I'm sorry. I got fired by a film.
I cry a lot lately.
I got dumped by an Ellen.
Do you love me?
Yes.
Good. I'll call.
And then, when things couldn't get any worse...
Drew, it's your sister. I have some really bad news.
I'll bring him home.
Louisville, Kentucky, huh? Home isn't your family.
My dad.
He's okay, right?
He's...
Stay for a while.
Uncle Mitch always wanted us to meet. Everybody says we look alike.
Weird, huh? Like looking in a mirror. This is your blood.
Life and death and life right next door to each other.
Right here is your grandfather.
He had three nipples.
Hello?
Hello, stranger.
Wait a second. I'll be right back. Hello?
You have to come home. She's out of control.
You will not defeat me.
We're gonna make it.
I need to call you right back.
No problem. Just dial hell and I'll answer.
We were actually gonna drive down here together. We were supposed to get to know each other better as adults next year.
Someone dug a hole 6 long, feet in the ground.
I have this thing for you.
It's a very unique map. It's for your road trip home.
Roll down your window.
I've had some time to think about it. And watch the sun sink like a storm. I've had some time.
This is your life. Let's do something interesting with it.
All along, right on.
Dad, we should have taken this trip years ago. I think you should eat something.
I've had some time to think about you.
Please don't take this as rejection.
I really don't.
Right home.
Written and directed by Cameron Crowe, starring Kirsten Dunst, Orlando Bloom, Paul Schneider, which Lars and the Real Girl. I was like, where do I know him from? It's another movie that I think Cassandra told us to watch. And then I'm like, oh my God, he's the brother in Lars. Susan Sarandon, fuck yeah, every time. Alec Baldwin, fabulous in this movie. Judy Greer, Bruce McGill, Jessica Biel, Paula Dean shows up out of nowhere. I was like, is that? Bird was like half watching with me and she goes, is that fucking Paula Dean? it's wild. And then in the best cameo I might have ever seen in my life, Jim Fitzpatrick as Rusty. Oh my God, he's fabulous. Cassandra, I'll say it right up top. I didn't start in this place, but by the time the credits rolled, there were tears on my face, my ribs hurt from laughing, and I like Elizabethtown. I like this movie a lot. It's so good. It's not right. So good, but my God, some parts of it are so good.
London Wainwright III also makes a guest appearance. I mean, he's a character in the movie.
Who's he?
This cat. He plays one of the family members, Uncle Dale.
Oh, right. Right, right. Okay.
Yeah. And I know, right? This is just like down on your luck, hard time, bad day, perfect movie to watch. I feel like it's, but it is cheesy and the ending kills it for me. But we'll get there eventually. But like,
you didn't like the ending?
I don't like that it ends with like a video montage of salmon. It feels weird.
That part was kind of, the salmon is, I don't know though. I might even be defending the salmon. I thought, okay, you did send me on a journey because we watched Garden State first. And yes. I know that like one of the things about Garden State Elizabethtown is everybody points out the plot of the two of them is remarkably similar.
So right. And it doesn't seem like they're copying each other because they come out right around the same year.
They feel very different. This movie's longer. Man, when I opened this up and I was like, 2 hours and 3 minutes I got to watch of this shit. Fuck. I was so bummed. So I'm like, all right, here we go. Rented the sucker. Put it on. And as I read through my notes, the first like 40 minutes of the movie is me like ready to hate it. Because I was talking with Connor about it too. You know, we did, by the time this comes out, the Interstellar episode will be really, the two-part Interstellar episode has so much crying in it. My God, we were both just emotional wrecks by the end of that one. But I was talking with Connor off mic afterwards, and he's like, "What are you? When's the next Manic Pixie Dream Girl episode?" I'm like, "I think I'm doing it this weekend. It's Elizabethtown." And he goes, "Yikes!" I'm like, "What?" And he goes, "I don't know, man. That might be one of the worst movies I've ever seen." So I think I came into it a little biased. I was ready to hate it. And that my early notes are all kind of like, you know, like very cynical, very like trying to dislike it. By the 50-minute mark or 45-minute mark, I was like kind of charmed. I'm like, oh, you know what? Some of this is pretty good. By the end, Bird had come over from her desk and was sitting on the couch with me, and we were just watching the movie. And at the end, we went and got like a box of Kleenex, and we were like crying. We're like, why do people not like this? It's exactly the right vibe that if you're having a bad day, you don't want to like sit there and like throw something on. This would be a good date night movie. You know, you don't have to pause it. Go and make your popcorn. Come back. Just don't miss the funeral scene. It's fucking epic.
And then did you know going into it that this was a true story?
It's like an adapted true story. This is the story right. of when Cameron Crowe went and first saw his father's grave in Kentucky, right? Like 16 years after he died.
And this yeah, and I mean, you know, the shoe being a total, like, was supposed to be huge, and then it's a failure in the movie. And like, really, in reality, he had just come out with Say Anything, and it wasn't great, but it looked like it was going to do well, you know, after they gave it a re-release. And he had told that to his dad, and his dad even went and did a article with the local paper like bragging about his son being a movie director. Mm-hmm. And he didn't find this out until after he passed away, because he died suddenly of a heart attack, like unexpectedly, in Kentucky. And yeah, he went back there and buried his dad. And then he's like driving home with his wife, and he wrote this movie.
It does have a different feel than a lot of his other movies. It feels there's an article or a review you sent me called "The Bataan Death March of Whimsy Elizabethtown,"
and that's
such
where
a hardcore title.
It is, and that's where the term Manic Pixie Dream Girl comes from. So yeah. It's from this 2005, when this movie comes out, this writer does an article just detailing all of the flops of the year, and he includes Elizabethtown, and he refers to Kirsten Dunst's character as a manic pixie dream girl, and it kind of snowballs from there. But what's weird is like he describes a manic pixie dream girl as having like no end game, or she's just there to fulfill the man's needs, but they right. end up together. So I don't.
And okay, yes, here I have some notes on this. Bizarrely, I was expecting, since this is the origin of the term, I was expecting like a really egregious example of a manic pixie dream girl. But of the manic pixie dream girls that we are going to see in this series, like, knowing what's coming next with Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind and Kate Winslet, and having just seen Natalie Portman, Claire is easily the least, like, the least stereotypical manic pixie dream girl. She's the best written of all of these characters, and Kirsten Dunst's performance as her is the most in-depth. Like, look, I'm going to defend this movie a lot tonight, and I know that some of the people who listen to my show really are, like, hardcore film people, and hearing me say nice things about Elizabeth Town might be kind of weird, but think about how they wrote her, right? She's written as this manic pixie dream girl. She's written huge. She's written, like, with that kind of quirky, whimsy thing that they talk about in that review. But Kirsten Dunst, like, either totally does or almost manages to make everything seem believable or seem as natural as it can, given the writing that she's given. She has some really interesting emotional beats in here. Like, Natalie Portman, I have a note that might, like, kind of help explain. That might kind of explain what I'm talking about here. So our first introduction to Claire, the early parts of this movie are a little annoying to me. There's, like, a kind of irritating vibe in the early section of the movie. Once we get to Elizabeth Town, that's where the movie changes for me, and it starts to get really good. But I have an early note. This is not necessarily about Claire. This is just general thoughts about the manic pixie dream girl. I was also kind of thinking about Kate Winslet, who we'll see next time. I said, Claire is kind of annoying, not as annoying as Natalie Portman was. She seems quirky, but a lot of the manic pixie dream girls seem not particularly respectful of other people's boundaries or even aware of them. A lot of them seem to exhibit self-obsession or intense narcissism as quirkiness. They don't listen. The world doesn't sink into a manic pixie dream girl. They make their own worlds like little cysts and live there exclusively. I think this is part of the attraction to the sad sack losers that end up glomming onto them. The guys want out of the hard world and so escape into constructed fantasies with borderline mentally ill people. And I was kind of ready. I was kind of ready to see Claire do the Natalie Portman thing and just be like, here's my house full of hamster tubes and here's where we bury them all. And just, like, weird, super weird shit. But that's not her. Honestly, I think Claire reminds me more of Penny Lane from Almost Famous than anybody else. She's more a dream girl than and a fairly well-rounded one, too.
And this movie is constantly asking a question. It's constantly saying, how do you say goodbye to somebody that you've just met? You know, and that's what you're asking yourself the whole time. They're constantly meeting and leaving each other. And Claire has a life. She has made up boyfriend, but we do see her apartment. She talks about her friends. She has a job.
She's clearly traveled and met people and formed. She's lived a full life, which we see at the end of the movie. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, no, exactly. She does feel like a real person.
More so than any of the other. I haven't seen 500 Days of Summer, but of the first three we're going to talk about, which all of which I've seen now, she's easily the best character of that set of three. The other two are just, like, cardboard cutouts of, like, insanity.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, Claire doesn't even really seem to be crazy at all. And
I agree.
And also, what's interesting, just a piece of trivia I found, is that her mom was a flight attendant.
Yeah, Kirsten Dunst's mom was.
Yeah.
For the Lufthansa airline. I saw that too.
There's something crazy about Kirsten Dunst in a flight attendant uniform. I just love, like, so much. It's, like, etched into my brain forever.
I know that occasionally, every once in a while, she'll get, like, some hate thrown at her for something. I don't know why people don't like Kirsten Dunst. I have seen so many movies with her over the years for the show, and she is almost always the best actor in them. She is phenomenal. Like, have you seen The Beguiled, the Sofia Coppola movie with Colin Farrell?
Yes.
Holy shit, dude. She's so fucking good in that. She's unreal. Melancholia. I can't think of a Kirsten Dunst joint that I didn't, like, totally love.
That's how I found this podcast, was looking for a virgin suicide podcast episode.
Yeah, the obvious one where she's she's incredible. She really is excellent.
I mean, An Interview with a Vampire. Like,
That is a movie I haven't seen.
Oh my God.
It's on the list. I'm going to watch it this October. It's part of my like 31 days of Halloween horror movie run.
That's so exciting. Okay.
Okay. So yeah, this fall I will have seen it. Maybe I'll watch it early. I don't know. I'm on like, I want to see more Kirsten Dunst stuff now because she's so fucking good. But yeah, so like you were saying, or like we've been talking about, she's got a job, right? She's not like, I might be lying about working in a law firm, or like,
yeah,
I just live at my house and like make weird art, like objet d'art, you know, and don't have an actual thing going on. She has a job. She works as a flight attendant. That's not in, you know, this is not like she works at a Burger King. Like, you got to kind of do some stuff to be a flight attendant. You got to be reliable. At the end of the movie, we'll just jump around. At the end of the movie, hey, you should stop at this diner, talk to this guy. He's owned it for 30 years. He'll tell you some great stories. That doesn't read to me like, oh, a weird quirk, she blah, blah, blah. No, she's a flight attendant. She lands in a lot of cities, and she's accumulated a lot of life experiences. She's just giving somebody a recommendation. Like, I work at a bar as my day job, and a lot of people come in and they're like, hey, where should we go for lunch? And you don't tell them the touristy spot. You tell them the like, oh, dude, you got to go to Sledder's, kiss the moose that's hanging on the wall. That's the oldest restaurant in Traverse City. It's been here for ages, lots of history. Or go here, this bartender makes, you know, you tell them the life experiences that you share your life experiences with others. I feel like a lot of the reviews of this movie that I saw online, actually, I almost forgot that review, the birthplace of the Manic Pixie Dream Girl. If you read that review all the way to the end, the guy lets it off the hook at the end. Like, he comes in really strong. He defines the Manic Pixie Dream Girl and shits all over it. And then the last paragraph, he's like, you know, even though this movie's weird and not very good, I keep talking about it and thinking about it all the time. And by the end of it, it had like barreled right through my defenses and like sunk into my heart. You know, so like this like legendary bad review that started this or named this film trope actually ends with it being like, Elizabeth Town's not terrible. It's a crazy movie, but it's not so bad. That's, I don't know. I feel like a lot of the reviewers have too much cynicism in their hearts, you know? Like,
oh, you can totally tell these reviews are from 2005, 2006. Like,
everyone
very
wants to be
edgy.
Like, yeah, everyone's watching, yeah, David Fincher do his thing, and they're like, this is, like, what's the one? There's a, it's actually in that same review, the Bataan Death March of Whimsy. It's he's talking about how he loves Cameron Crowe's other movies, but this one doesn't work because like he's too like in his heart when he should be using his brain. And I'm like, incorrect. Like, what makes Elizabeth Town work is that it's not heady. It's almost, sorry, go ahead.
He called it an X-ray into his soul, like as an insult.
I know. And like, what a compliment, dude. Like, this guy got his heart onto a screen. The early parts are it flails a little bit at the top. It doesn't quite know what it's doing, although I have theories about that, too.
Yes. Yes. Well, and Claire is a studier of people, right? And so we get the crazy bike at the beginning, which the suicide bike I hate. But then I think I always just tell myself, like, look, he's a horrible inventor of shoes. Maybe that's why he's horrible at orchestrating his own death. But the same as you, like, I just want to get past the first 10 minutes of the movie
and into it. Once you're I hated the suicide bike too, although the knife coming unstuck is like, it's just funny enough, and the timing of the cell phone buzzes is kind of funny, but that suicide bike is bullshit.
Seeing Jessica Biel is always a treat that I forget about.
Yeah, and she's a smoke show for sure.
Hearing Alec Baldwin say, the American psyche is in turmoil and we have miscalculated.
Okay, wait. Can we talk for just a second about how good Alec Baldwin is in this
brilliant
movie? Okay, he's like, but here, like, okay, the movie fucks up in the if you can just watch the first 20 minutes of this movie without your jaded, cynical heart, like, calcifying on you, listener, this movie can really get under your skin. I don't like the whole, like, he has an obsession with two, and then the dialogue all starts incorporating the word two over and over and over again. He walks through the office, his continual repetition of, I'm fine. I could do without that. But the second he walks into Alec Baldwin's office and Alec Baldwin starts talking to him, oh my God, but as he walks him, he's trying to visually explain to Drew what $972 million looks like. And he walks past that room and he's like, we're going to have to cancel our ecological watchdog program. We could have, they don't know yet. We could have literally saved the world.
We could have saved the rainforest.
Yeah, we could have.
It's the, like, basketball team.
Yeah, the basketball team's practicing. They're all fired. Like, they're all fired. His eco watchdog program's all fired. And then Alec Baldwin, the part that gets me is when he's leaning over the railing, he goes, that is the sound of the shit hitting the fan. Do you hear it? And Drew goes really quiet, and then it cuts back, and Alec Baldwin just goes, does this big fucking tongue fart sound. Dude, there's a reason that he's, you know.
He's so good in this movie.
He's good in everything. Alec Baldwin's top tier. Oh, man, he's funny as shit. I love all this stuff. Walk with me. He takes his hands. I've been crying a lot lately.
I do hate the dialogue, like the over, you know, talking over like you do, but also I will,
is that what you're,
yeah,
about?
The voiceover.
Yeah, I don't like the VO either.
But some of that stuff, it sticks with me though. Like there is a couple of lines of voiceover from this movie that I think about all the time still. Like, that's a last look.
Yeah,
like every once in a while, I'll have a last look with somebody, and I think to myself, that's a last look right there.
Yeah, he says something like that. He's like, I'm a collector. I've become a connoisseur of last looks.
Yeah.
The best one is in the event hall at the hotel at the funeral with fucking Skinner just ripping in the background and the rain and, I mean, the sprinkler system and Claire. The look on Kirsten Dunst's face where she's just like, she's like, in that moment, she embodies what she's trying to impart to him, which is just, sometimes everything goes to shit and all you can do is just surrender to it and laugh.
If it wasn't this, it'd be something else.
Exactly. Yeah. And then even the banner, you know, and the banner
words
says,
I live by, literally.
If it wasn't this, it'd be something else.
Mm-hmm.
The banner burns down to if something else.
That's awesome.
I know. I do like, go ahead.
Well, it's hard to realize that Susan Sarandon and Kirsten Dunst are in this movie simultaneously. I mean, they're never in a scene together, really.
They're in the same room in that last scene, or in that funeral scene, but
there's a way to view this movie where Susan Sarandon's stuff doesn't work and is not funny, and I choose not to view it that way, but
I think half of, look, I love Susan Sarandon. I love her. I would say about half of her stuff doesn't work and is not funny. And you know what's really shitty is I love Judy Greer, too. I think Judy Greer is great.
And she does not work in this movie. It's weird.
I give it her like 50-50 if I'm being generous. I think like 60% of her stuff doesn't work, too. The writing is pitchy for sure. But this movie, once you get into it, the movie's really not about its writing. It's about a feel. It's like a tone.
They're in two different movies almost.
Yeah.
The Bat family and then the rest of the movie, which maybe is intentional.
But are they? I mean, that's what I mean. Maybe they are in two different movies. They're in California. I have a note about this. So I have a lot of notes. I said, I wonder if some of the stiffness, awkwardness, irritating coldness in the beginning is meant to portray the detached and unnatural nature of the West Coast corporate thing, juxtaposed when we get to Elizabethtown, it feels like a different movie. When he drives into Elizabethtown, his arrival, beautiful. The way it's shot, it so captures small town America. When he's first coming down that main drag with the trees on either side, it almost reminds me of some of the shots of Virgin Suicide where they're doing that like almost like powder lens. It's like you're driving back in time to like another era where the world is a little bit warmer somehow kind of vibe. And then when you contrast that with the beginning of the movie, it does feel intentional. It feels like California is not a place you want to be. Not to bring it back to Garden State, but like this is how Garden State feels a little bit too. When you're in his apartment and he's in the, like when he's on the West Coast, things feel unreal. It feels like a weird dream nightmare and everyone's cold and distant. And then he gets home and we get like the wacky adventure, but I almost wonder if Elizabethtown is doing kind of the same thing here and it just didn't work, you know, like the intention's there, but it doesn't quite hit.
It's weird. And I wonder, I always figured I just didn't like the actor Orlando Bloom. I've never seen anything else that he's in.
You're shitting.
Besides this. No.
What?
I've never seen like the Pirates movies or anything.
What? I just watched Curse of the Black Pearl the other night. Okay, Cassandra, you've got to watch Pirates of the Caribbean. Those movies are fun as fuck. They're great.
I understand, like, this is his first normal role, right? Not playing a superhero
this, he's in what? Troy? He's in Troy. I think he plays Paris, right?
And he had done some Pirates movies.
You should watch Pirates of the Caribbean. It's really good. He's also amazing as Legolas in the Lord of the Rings trilogy. Are you not a Lord of the Rings fan? Is that what's going on here?
No, I like Lord of the Rings. So I've seen Lord of the Rings, at least the first one, at least multiple times. But I don't know. I've probably only seen the other ones once or twice, like a long time ago.
I know, like this. They're worth it. The extended cuts are even better too. But like, yeah, I think he's good as Legolas in that. I love him in the Pirates movies.
I'm just saying, just to point out to certain people that I may have been arguing with about this, I didn't know that he was foreign and watched this whole movie and then found out after that he was foreign and has an accent. But Nicole Kidman, you can literally just hear her accent through any movie. So how is she a good actress?
Practical Magic is my favorite. When you watch Practical Magic, her Australian like lilt just all over the joint. Bird and I play a game where we try and like catch it every time. We'll get like 10 in the movie sometimes. But
it's wild.
It doesn't really bother me that much though. You know what I mean? It's almost like that thing with Robert Downey Jr. where a lot of the time he's playing Robert Downey Jr. Even when he's really like digging into the character and burying himself, like everyone points to, what do they call it? Is it called The Soloist? The one with Jamie Foxx, the cello. Anyway, Nicole Kidman, there's something about her on screen where it doesn't bother me that her accent slips. Does it bug you?
It bugs me, and I don't, maybe that's why I don't love some of the Orlando Bloom stuff. Maybe I just don't like him as an actor, but that makes me wonder, like, do you think that anybody could have played these two, the lead characters, Claire and Drew?
I don't think
so. And it worked? Okay.
They
filmed a lot with Ashton Kutcher before they fired him.
I read online that Cameron Crowe thought that Ashton Kutcher and Kirsten Dunst had absolutely no chemistry, so they scrapped it and waited until Bloom was available. And actually, I also read that his initial casting, his desired casting for Claire and Drew, was Kirsten Dunst and Orlando Bloom, but Orlando Bloom was busy shooting another movie, so he couldn't do it. So they kind of like tried to recast, and shitloads of people were in here or were like up for these roles, but nothing landed. Like, I think, what's his name? Sean William Scott, the American Pie guy. He was like a strong front runner contender, but
I could see that.
I am personally an Orlando Bloom fan. So is Bird. Bird might like him for different reasons than I do. He is kind of a dreamboat.
Yeah, I like him from this.
But yeah, I don't know. I think he actually does. Once we get, like I said, if you just, like, let's just cut the beginning of the movie off.
Yeah.
If you don't think about the beginning of the movie, I think he does a really good job. I think he's funny and charming. His performance is pretty good. Some parts of it hit a little flat, but also I think he suffers a little bit from being across from Kirsten Dunst, who's actually doing like really amazing work in here. Here's the moment that I'm thinking about in particular. So one of my big complaints with Natalie Portman is that she's not a real person at all in Garden State. I love Natalie Portman as an actress. I know that was a harsh thing to say, but like in Garden State, she's shitty. And then that whole movie, Zach Braff just kind of like runs the show. Here's what I want from you. Let's go do it. And she's like, okay, you know, and that's kind of the vibe of that. In this one, there's a moment in here that like what felt like an echo of that final airport scene in Garden State. And it's the one night stand at the hotel. And Claire wakes up and she's like making lots of noise because she wants him to ask her to stay. Let's have breakfast. Let's see where this goes. But I don't believe that he's sleeping that heavily. Dude, when she drops the bag and it's like filled with like broken glass and barbells and he's still sleeping. Nah, I call bullshit. But okay, fine. She gets down to the main lobby and is leaving and he runs out and chases her and she turns around like, ugh, better late than never. And rather than be like, don't go, I had such a good time, you and I are bonding, and like rather than making that this moment about them or her, he makes it about him and his failings and why, you know, we can't be together because you'd be so embarrassed to be with a failure, which is all like totally just egoic, like self-interest type shit. When she gives him, like reads him the riot act, do I have it right here? Yeah, I don't.
When she's like, so this has all been mostly about a shoe?
Yeah, exactly. She like gives him the, you're worried about that? Like, who cares about that? And then she gives him good advice. She goes, have the guts to fail big and stick around, you know? And she does the air quotes manic pixie dream girl thing, but the way that it's delivered, she's not like some magical character who's here to like only fix his problems. She's here like a real, actual, thoughtful human being who's listened to this guy's issue and then given advice back to him. There's nothing about this, about almost any of her lines, that strikes me as like, oh, she's this character of whimsy who helps him rediscover life. She's just like a person who's lived a very full, interesting, active life. And she sees this guy's kind of stunted and stifled and stymied. And she's just a cool person who kind of like helps him break out. I have friends like this. I have no friends like Natalie Portman or like the next film we're going to talk about. I don't even know people like that. If I meet people like that, I'm like, oh, fuck. No, I don't have any money. Sorry. And then I like try and get away from them. But Claire, I actually have a couple friends who are kind of like Claire. I used to party with them pretty hard in my 20s, you know?
That's where it freaked me out. I'm like, well, I'm definitely a lot like this character and have been for many years. And there's, you know, supposedly something deeply flawed about that. So I want to try and understand it. Like, even to the point where Ebert later on wrote an entire article theorizing that she was really an angel.
I was wondering, was that review that you sent me, is that by Ebert or is that by one of Ebert's reviewers?
I think it's by him. It's really bizarre, right?
Yeah,
it's by Roger Ebert. And it's crazy that they can't, like, a woman can't be interesting or smart. It has to be like
literally
blown.
An angel.
Yeah, it has to be made into these other weird categories. It's like we have to put her in some other category because they can't be co-stars yet, right? Because the world doesn't work like that yet.
I hadn't thought of it that way, but that is kind of right. That's the feeling of this is like with this character, she's acting like a crazy person was the early like 2005 reviews. She really isn't. She's just like an emotionally in tune, vivacious. She's like an Audrey Hepburn character.
Yeah. And I mean, obviously the director loves Audrey Hepburn.
Oh, yes.
Of course.
Sure.
But And also, like, yes, she does have these quirky qualities, but, like, also, you know, she reads people by their names. Like, that's something that me and my friends definitely do. Like, me and my friend Shauna constantly, when we are talking about somebody, I'll be like, ooh, they're a Paul. Yikes. Like, be careful. Pauls are crazy. We know what happens with Pauls. Like,
my buddy Brandon does this. And honestly, one thing I was thinking about during the name thing is I was like, don't we kind of all as a society do that? Why is that weird? Like,
yeah, she's a people watcher. And I think it's because of her job, right? She watches people all the time, and she just has to make these little, you know, stories about them or like assumptions.
I do this behind the bar all the time. And it's easy. Once you're around people a lot, you just pick stuff up. Like, you can tell. I can tell within maybe 60 seconds of somebody coming through the door, like, how that is going to go. And any server, I'm not like some crazy empath or whatever. Like, any server can do this. If a four top walks in, you can look at that table and be like, that tip's either going to be good or shitty. These people are going to be picky and needy, or these people are relaxed and chill. You can look at a person and read them. We pick up on so much stuff that's not overt. We pick up on subtle little stuff that we're not even aware we're recognizing. But yeah, another thing I really like about her, I like how you put that earlier. I want to remember that. You said that your critique of Ebert's secondary review was that women can't be smart or interesting. They have to be, like, I wouldn't call her quirky. Quirky feels dismissive. I think she's just eccentric. Like, David Bowie is an eccentric person. But everybody loves and respects David Bowie and wishes they could be more like that. When I look at Claire, like, there's a lot about Claire that I would rather embody. I don't want to be anything like Natalie Portman. She doesn't seem to have a good grip on shit. Claire just seems kind of like fun and going with the flow, like easygoing, but not deficient in any way. She's not reliant on Orlando Bloom. You know what I mean? She's not reliant on Drew. That scene, I finally found my note on that scene where she gives, like, kind of reads him the riot act, but also gives him great advice after that one night stand. She says, she gives him the advice, fail big and stick around. And I said, Claire's got agency. She has her own desires. She has her own life that she goes back to when, you know, like, she's kind of pursuing this thing with Drew, but when he, like, falls through, she's genuinely disappointed in him. You can see it in her face in the performance. And she starts to cry, but rather than do that, like, I am a child with no handle on my emotions thing that Portman does. Sorry, Natalie Portman. I fucking love you in Annihilation and Hesher. You're a genius. You're such a good actress. It's not Natalie Portman's fault. Like, it's the writing in both of these movies. It's just amazing to me that Kirsten Dunst can take the writing in this movie and not oversell it, but embody it in a way that is a person. So she gets really emotional and is gonna cry, and you can see that the reason that she's starting to cry, which she doesn't, she manages to, like, stifle that down and get through her goodbye and says, like, I'll catch you another time, dude, and gives him the brush off. This is not her, like, I just love you so much. She's like, okay, dude, you got some shit to deal with and figure out, obviously. Let's do this another time. And she pieces. She's the adult in that room, 100%. But I love that she's not just sad. It's kind of like a Bechdel test thing. She's not just sad because this guy wasn't thinking of her after, like, the one night stand. It's that she had misread him and she was, like, somehow disappointed in herself for... Sorry, I'm getting text messages. I gotta silence these. They're driving me nuts. People, I don't know. Bird's sending me Tango in the Night remastered. I'll listen to it later. But yeah, she does try to help him. You know, Drew's letting her down in multiple ways. It affects her emotionally, but she gets through that and goes on with her life. But she does try to help him because that's who she is. I get a sense of character. Like, she is actually a character. She's not here to serve Drew. So let me see what else. Yeah, Susan Sarandon's early stuff's not very good. All right. So the phone call. the all-night phone call.
Yes.
What do you think of this?
I mean, this felt revolutionary to me when I first saw it, right? I'm just like, this encapsulates something that is so unexplainable. And now probably, I don't even know if kids still do this or anything, but.
They just text for infinity. But okay, I'm so glad you said that. You also remember doing this, right?
Oh, yeah.
The whole entire night until the sun comes up, you're on the phone and you're doing that thing where you're like, are you asleep yet? Okay, let's just fall asleep with the phone and we'll hear each other breathe as we sleep. Like, this is not quirky. This is not Manic Pixie Dream Girl shit. This is early stage relationship stuff.
Yeah.
This is totally real. I've done this so many times in my life.
All the time. I even had a group of friends that, like, we would call each other and go on three-way, and one of our friends would just read us, like, a book that he was writing, and he would just read it to us, and we'd, like, sit on the phone for hours and listen.
Dude, that's okay. So when I first started dating Bird, we went to the same college, and I met her during, like, the last 3 months of a semester. The long story short, we fell in love, like, hard. We were both dating other people at the time, kind of like Drew's parents were in Hawaii, both engaged and split for each other. Bird and I got out of those, like, we were both in, like, toxic, shitty relationships, and we ended up together, married 11 years now. But she left Northern, where we met, after that semester was done, and I was going to stay there. And she's like, well, I'll be 6 hours away. Do you want to, like, try and do a long distance thing? It never works. I'm like, fuck it. I'm definitely not losing you. So one of the things we would do is call each other and literally stay on the phone all night, every night. And one of our favorite things to do on the phone is I would read her, like, Neil Gaiman short stories over the phone. Like, whatever I was reading, whatever book I was reading or whatever book she was reading, she liked listening to me read. So I would, or I, maybe she was just, like, doing this to, like, you know, to humor the cute boy that she was dating. But I used to, like, read big giant chunks of books to her for hours at night. I loved this detail. I hate the early part of that call when everyone's on hold. Oh, I'll call you back.
Yeah.
But again, maybe we're supposed to, because
I think it's supposed to be like, well, okay, there's one way you could look at it and be like, look, she'll just sit there and wait for him.
Sure.
Right. It's kind of true.
I didn't read it that way. Again, like, I didn't really read it that way. I just read it as, like, first of all, what's she got to lose? It's not like she's sitting alone in her living room, like, just waiting on this call. She's in action. She's walking out of the airport. She's on her way home. So she's not really losing anything by just, like, holding the phone up to her ear. It's kind of rude what he's doing, but she's not just, like, twiddling her thumbs. She's still a person in action. I've been put on hold for a long time. But, like,
and she kind of knows that he's got something going on, even though he hasn't admitted it to her yet.
Because she recognized on the airplane that his dad had died.
Yeah.
Like, she just can see it, you know? Her calling, her, like, yelling after him in the airport, it almost feels like nothing solidifies into what it actually is until, like, the last two-thirds of the movie. In the beginning, there's stuff that doesn't recur. She doesn't really continue to behave that way. That, like, early wacky zaniness.
Super annoying, like, kind of not respecting his boundaries.
Yeah, that's just, like, I almost feel like that, like, a couple more drafts of the script would have fixed that. Because all mm-hmm. that behavior stops once the phone call happens. The phone call is the turning point for me for this movie. After the phone call, pretty much everything is great. Because that's, we find out, you know, like, oh, I'm supposed to go to Hawaii tomorrow, you know, so hey, we should meet. I even kind of think it's cute that they stay on the phone until they drive and meet each other halfway. And then to admit that they peaked on the phone. I thought that was funny. Yeah. Pretty good writing. You know, like they watch the sunrise and she, but they both acknowledge like they're both fucking dead tired. They're like, yeah, we peaked on the phone. All right. Well, I'll catch you later. I like the montages. I like the music video vibe of some of it. It does feel like very early 2000s, but
the soundtrack to this movie is insane.
It's killer. It's so insane.
Good. Like, there is something to be said about writing a scene that can utilize some of these really larger than life songs, right? It's like, how do you write to this kind of music, or do you even need to?
Isn't there, there's like an acoustic, a really cool like flamenco acoustic cover of Big Love at the beginning of this movie.
There's so much good music in this movie. Mac. There's Tom Petty.
Yeah, Petty shows up. The most iconic, for me, the absolute apex of this movie is when Ruckus comes out and plays Freebird at the funeral. That goes so hard. And that band is My Morning Jacket, by the way. The people up on stage with him, I mean, well, it's Paul Schneider on drums, but the rest of the people on stage are the members of My Morning Jacket.
Okay.
So, who have a great cover, by the way, of Rocket Man. For listeners, if you haven't heard My Morning Jacket's cover of Rocket Man, I heard it on Californication for the first time, and I was like, who the fuck was that? It's such a good cover. I like it better than Elton John's version. Controversial statement.
I've listened to the soundtrack to this movie like 100 times. I mean, I've listened to it all the time. It's got so much good music on it. It's got like gospel music. It's got everything, literally everything. I don't know. I don't even know how they fit so much music into this movie, honestly. But well, I guess the road trip, really.
Yeah, the road trip is just like song after song after song. It's almost like, you know what it is? The feel of the movie, it's perfect because the way that it feels is exactly what it is on the screen. It's just a music. It's somebody who loves music, in this case, Cameron Crowe, but Claire, showing all their favorite songs to somebody else who they really like. It honestly, in 2024, I don't know if this even still works the same way because I don't know if people do mixtapes for each other anymore.
They do playlists.
Playlists? Okay. So this is another part of this. Not to this extent, right? I know one of the big complaints, like even Bird was like, holy shit, do you know how much work it would take for her to like make this map and write all these playlists down and like time shit out? And I had three thoughts immediately. First, this is a movie. We don't make movies about average, normal people. I mean, Richard Linklater does, and he's a genius, but he's a genius. That's why it works for him. It's like the Greeks. They always made plays about kings and warriors. You know, like, we make movies about exceptional people who do wild stuff because we like to watch wild and crazy cool stuff. That map is awesome. That playlist, that whole concept is so fucking cool. And so, even if it's not accurate to life, it catches a certain feeling about the absolutely wild, crazy honeymoon early stages of a relationship. That is very true to life. I have done something like that before. I took every single like CD in my collection, all the music that I loved, and I grabbed deep cut stuff and I matched stuff by BPM, and I'm like, this band actually split. And then the first song is the singer of the first band, and the second song after it's the guitarist. And then they read like, and I wrote it all out in a notebook, like this size, you know, just like little notebook. And I wrote, each CD had its own like liner notes that I had done telling a story. I drew pictures and shit. It was ended up being It was like 12
discs.
You're
a Claire.
And I gave I gave it to a girlfriend because I was like, now you'll understand my music. And it was so I was in high school, so I'm like, this will help her understand. And she was like a Taylor Swift fan, and I was giving her like, it's Godhead, Silo, and fucking, you know, Big Black, and she just didn't get it at all. But I spent like a week and a fucking half doing all this, and then a friend of our, of me and Birds, did this for us. When we moved out of Marquette, she was sad we were leaving, and she made us, we were moving to Maine, so she figured out how long the drive from Marquette to Maine would be, and made us like a 5-disc playlist with notes on why she'd chosen the songs and where we would be in our journey. It wasn't as in-depth as Claire's, but like, when I saw that, and like, you read it in reviews sometimes where people are like, and that was one of the things that some of my buddies were like, that's such bullshit, no one would do that.
No,
I'm like, I know two
people
who
sense.
Did it.
Yeah, I mean, CDs were a thing, and like, you would, I don't know how many CDs I burned for my boyfriends or crushes or whatever, you know, and it was like our love mix, date night mix, whatever. You know, cruising mix.
Okay, I just, and also since she is a one of the my followers on Patreon. I think it's my sister-in-law. I never know how that shit works. So my brother and sister-in-law, when Bird and I went on our honeymoon, also did this, a 5-disc set for our drive through Canada and down the coast. We like, here's all this music, and it had boogie, like
how
everything
bizarre.
From like Boogie Woogie's song to like Neutral Milk Hotel, and it was all curated, and each disc had its own, they were all color coded, and each disc was kind of like the vibe of the color they'd chosen. So I saw that and I was like, fuck yeah, dude. And look at this. Anyway, that
I wonder if man. These people have seen this movie. Yeah.
It is not well reviewed online.
But I did have the same thought as Bird. I was like, how would she be able to map it out? But then I thought, like, this Claire didn't make this for Drew. Claire has done this drive 100 times, as a matter of fact. You know, she's just being nice and like throwing in a couple of things for Drew. She's, you know, putting in a couple extra love songs, hoping he likes her, and she's just gonna give him the map. And it's just basically to show him how amazing she is.
What I was thinking about that when I, especially that, and I love that scene. It's like the last almost 20 minutes of the movie is that road trip. And like, what I was thinking about when Bird was like, that would take so much time. I'm like, I don't think it would, because Claire has, like you said, Claire has been to all of these places, right? So she just takes out a map. And she goes, all right, where would, you know, like, where do I want, where have I been that I love, and how can I, like, guide him to those places? And then she just picks, like, if you wanted, I could tell you 100 songs in a row right now that I just fucking love. And if I had, you know, a couple of days or whatever, like, a few hours in the evening, I could probably, like, cure, I could do this. This is not as like, a titanic a task. I think some of these cynical ass reviewers are just lazy, and I feel bad for their significant others. Like, this ain't that bad. This is just a great, this is a really excellent present to give somebody.
For so, anybody who so did cool. love this movie, like, so much, there's actually a TV show that came out that premiered when this came out called Paula Dean's Going to Hollywood. And it is the cutest thing you've ever seen. And it's Paula Dean, like, really, really, really excited that she's going to Hollywood to become famous. And she's going to meet a real director and real actors and all this. And she's like, we're going to meet my co-stars for the movie Elizabethtown. Come on, y'all. And like, it's so amazing. And she's just like, over the moon in every scene of the episode. And it's her like getting ready for the premiere and like just talking about what it was like to work with all these great actors, and she's just amazing. And then I got to learn all about like her origin story, which is really cool.
Okay.
Like her and her boys, and like she's like this hardworking chef and like had her own restaurant and raised these boys on her own, and just like really, really cool. And but what those scenes with her, and she brings Drew up to the bedroom, and she's showing him all these pictures, right? And she's like, you know, this is your aunt, this is your uncle, this is this person, this is this person. Like, you stay up here as long as you need. I love that scene. She's so good. I had a moment like that not that long ago because I had gone to my uncle's funeral and I really wasn't that close with him. But at one point in time, my dad, like, he, during him and my mom's separation, would be like, I'm getting rid of this, I'm getting rid of that. And there would be like boxes of pictures. And I'm like, whoa, 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 whoa. Okay. And I think both of my parents have done this. And so I've just taken the pictures and hoarded them because I'm like, why are they throwing this stuff away? They're not realizing what they're doing, you know?
Right, right.
And after my uncle's funeral, I'm like, I know I have a picture of my uncle, like, in his Navy uniform going off to Vietnam in front of my grandparents' house, or like, and I found it. And I just have like all of these pictures, and I was showing the kids, like, that's your great, great grandfather. Like, that's your great uncle. That's this person, you know? And my parents don't even know that I still have these pictures, and maybe they have copies of them, but I'm like, I'm going to put these away just because they're family history, you know?
Yeah. Recently, when my grandma died, I think you're right. Like, they don't really know what they're doing is a good way to put it. Or like in the immediate aftermath of losing somebody, the like intensity of grief is so high that seeing those pictures is painful. So you just want to get rid of them. You're like, fuck it, we're just gonna, no, I can't look at these ever again. It hurts so much to look at them. I can't ever imagine looking at them. Let's just burn everything, and then I can put it all behind me, or like not have to think about it, or oh my, like they're almost, it's almost like they're not in their right mind. And I there was definitely like they were going, I remember sitting down at the kitchen table with my mom and just going through like photo album after photo album after photo album, all shit I'd never seen.
Yeah,
you know, like I the amount of pictures that my family accrues is amazing, but like pictures of relatives that I didn't even know I had, sort of stuff. And like, where's this? And you're like, oh, that's, you know, this picture's in Finland or whatever. And you're like, what? Holy shit, that far back? And yeah, a lot of that stuff was just going to go. Or like a big box of, after my uncle Walt died, there was like a big box of his writing. He was a creative writing student like I was. And he just like all like a bunch of short stories and poetry and like old essays that he'd written. And they were just like, yeah, it's just old homework. We're going to throw this away. I'm like, this is the creative output of that guy's life. So I have a
throw
box.
Throw it away. That's insane. And so there was this interview with Cameron Crowe and, you know, Bobby Wygant. She asked him, what if you could ask your dad anything, or if you could say something to him, what would it be? And he's like, well, Bobby, you know, I would tell my dad, just thank you for writing letters, you know, because he wrote letters. And they show that in the movie, too. And I guess that was a true thing, that he would write letters to people all the time. And like, that's something that you do. Like, I've got a book of yours that you wrote a letter to me in. And yeah, I'll look at it from time to time. Yeah. And it's just cool because like, yeah, messages or whatever and emails and stuff. And you could argue that it might never get deleted, but it's like, it's cool to have physical media.
Yeah. There's I've just recently, I'm doing a book club with my friend Alicia right now. They were doing this book by this great philosopher named Byung-Chul Han. He's Korean-born German philosopher, and he's got this book called The Burnout Society that's just will change your life, rewire your head. It's fabulous. And one of the things he talks about is that we're losing, the way he talks about it is he says, everybody equates, like, we're losing this. Like, listeners can't see it, but I'm holding a book in my hand, right? Well, people say like, well, one day this book will get old and the binding will fall apart, and or it could get wet and damaged and then it's gone. So people are somehow associating physical objects with impermanence. They're like, that's just it's a fleeting thing that will one day rot. But in the digital, that's forever. You know, the binding will never go bad. You can just keep it. But he argues that that's totally fucking backwards for starters. One, anybody who's ever had a deteriorated hard drive where all your data is corrupted and you can't recover anything knows that digital shit is not forever. Unless you put it on the internet and then it's for fucking ever. But
what about a solar flare?
Yeah, exactly. A solar flare or an EMP, or there's a bajillion ways. It's all of the, anything that's just like reliant on electricity or whatever, that's all just gossamer. You know, this is an illusion. You and I are looking, we're staring into an illusion right now. This is very illusory. And the other thing that he said is one of the things that we lose when we get rid of a physical object like a book is we lose touch with the physical. If we move entirely online, we start to lose our sense of exteriority of the outer world. We don't touch things. We don't pick things up, handle them, hold them in our hands, riffle the pages. There's something, there's a reason that people can have, I have 700 emails in my inbox unread. There's a reason that people will get emails and they're just like, fuck, I got a bunch of emails. Do you know anybody who gets a letter and goes, fuck, I got a letter? They're like, oh my God, I got a letter. And they open it and they unfold it and then they read it. And that will, people will keep them for years. Have you ever kept an email that wasn't like business related? No one gives a shit about an email. It's just a way to communicate. But a letter is a communication from one person to another, something done with someone's hand. I have these, I'm so fucking nerdy about this shit, but I collect fountain pens, and they just, when you write with a fountain pen, you can, I have all these different beautiful colors of ink, and I have flexi nibs that add like this kind of copper plate vibe to the handwriting. There's something so beautiful. And there's something almost, I know it sounds like so woo-woo, but there's something like spiritual to me about getting a letter from someone, about having like a written correspondence with people. There's something different about that than a text message or an email.
Oh, yeah. And I think you could even make the argument that it's like, maybe you could say, well, you're losing a sense of ego and reality or physical reality when you transfer everything online. But it's like, is that a good, you know, that's kind of a bad thing. Like, people tend to be the worst versions of themselves, even when you're getting rid of that ego. Like, it somehow makes it worse. Like, I don't know that it's like taking away the ego. Do you know what I mean?
I totally know what you mean. Are you saying that, because this is how I feel, people oftentimes are the worst versions of themselves online, like,
yes,
in comment threads, or it's easier to be nasty on a text message or a comment thread or a message board than it is face to face or whatever. Online is very depersonalizing in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I guess I'm just saying to myself, like, the difference between, like, the separation between like the physical self and online, and how people can, you know, just have everything online and seemingly be detached from reality. It's like, yeah, that it is one way to live, but also it's kind of, you know, awful. It's not even just that, like, writing a letter is more charming. It's almost like the alternative is actually dangerous and like the literal destruction of our society.
I completely agree with you. I switch the words a little bit. I think that in a lot of ways, the internet and social media and online culture, or just online, capital O, is actually ego inflating in a lot of ways. But what we actually...
But the language they use, it's very tricky, because they make it like they, right? Like, from the movie, like, who is,
sure,
they?
You know, them.
But it's like, yeah, them. they make it to where they'll say, like, you know, you're more advanced because you're online. Like, you're more at one with everybody in the world. Constant communication, networking, accessibility. These are all supposed to be like advantages and positives,
sure,
right? Transcendence, like, we're transcending into this virtual world. We're supposed to be happy about that.
Right. Yeah. I know what you mean. What I was just going to say was, I think that online can be ego inflating, and I'll talk about that in just a sec, but what we lose when we go online is not ego, but self. Like, you lose self-definition. And I think one of the reasons for that is I think that the way that algorithms work, you get locked into... Basically, you get locked into echo chambers, and I'm totally stealing this for the, we're talking literally about stuff that's in the first chapter of The Burnout Society. So Han posits that we are losing contact with the other. He describes other as something that you have to contend with and actually encounter and butt up against, something that strongly disagrees with you, but not just something that you're going to like clap back against or pile on and roast, right? Like, I'm a liberal hippie dude. I go online, someone's like, you know, rah, rah, pro-war or like hardcore Trumpy or whatever. The impulse when I'm online is not to listen, genuinely listen to and allow some interiority, consider those thoughts, encounter that person and their ideas, and then engage with them so that in that moment of clashing with them, that borderline is my self-definition. It's how I form self. Instead, what I do is my ego gets a huge glut when I'm online, because all I'm really doing is I'm using pattern recognition to see there's a person that I can pile on and reinforce my own intrinsic biases by just like shitting all over them with this other big swarming group of people. So Byung-Chul Han has this really interesting idea that I will not be able to get out as eloquently as he does. But basically what he says is, even though it feels like everything, we're all at odds with each other and everything's, we're all butting heads and stuff, everything is actually kind of homogenizing into a sort of sameness. And since everything's kind of becoming the same, there's nothing outside of ourselves against which to define ourselves. So we're all losing our sense of self while we're all constantly having our own biases and thoughts and beliefs reinforced in echo chambers. So our egos get crazy out of control while we lose who we are simultaneously. It's like,
I've been thinking about that for like a year, ever since you said that to me. You said, it's scary sometimes how much everybody sounds the same. And at the time that you said it to me, I was like, yeah, I guess. But then the next day I'm like listening to podcasts and people just using the exact same phrases over and over and over. Just a weird example, like juxtaposition. Like, that was a huge word for like 6 months, right? Sure. And I couldn't go more than like 2 hours without hearing it. And I'm like, Max is right. Like, everyone's literally just saying the same effing shit over and over and over and parroting each other. Like, this is wild. There's a very limited amount of like original thought or content, which I guess, you know, kind of is addressed by Natalie Portman in Garden State.
These movies are teaching us so much.
This is what I do when I feel unoriginal. Oh, God. No, don't do it. Just blend in, Natalie.
Yeah, Natalie, you could use a little more blending. Honestly, you might be a little too original for all of us.
And I wonder, too, like, is Natalie Portman just not that great of an actress, but she's given really good scripts?
Maybe. I mean, I don't know. I don't know if it's your kind of movie, but you should check out Annihilation, man. Annihilation's really fucking good. And then there's that. I did recommend another good Natalie Portman one for you, Hesher. But to be honest, I think she's good in that movie, but she's the least good of the good parts of that movie. I love her in that movie, but I know it sounds like I don't like Natalie Portman, but dude, I like her a lot. I think she's great. in that movie, it is undeniable. In Garden State, she was given an impossible task. When you look at like what she was told to do, what she was told to say, I can't think of a single actress who could have done any better. You know what I mean? No one was going to do anything with that material. It was rough.
No, and that's where I kind of was like, well, Kristen Dunst would have done it better, but this is a much better script.
Yeah, like I would be curious to see what Kirsten Dunst could do with the Garden State script, seeing what she did with this. And I mean, I like Zach Braff. Like, here's the thing. I like all the different component pieces that go into mm-hmm. Garden State. I just don't like Garden State. Like, that particular project doesn't work for me. I think I said it on that episode, but like, one of my big problems with Garden State is it feels like in the episode of Scrubs that happens right before JP goes to, or whatever his name is, goes to medical school. You know, it's like, this is what happened the year before he met Turk. Yeah. You know, like, it has that same kind of like zany wackiness, and that kind of like abrates against the like more heartfelt elements of this. Whereas this movie, once you get through the flailing at the beginning, is Cameron Crowe's heart on the screen. So like, it's all heart, and the funny stuff works because it doesn't feel like, oh, I made a shirt for you out of the drapes material, you know, like that's
right.
That's kind of shticky, you know,
like it might not be funny and it might not be great. Like Susan Sarandon doing tap dancing to Moon River.
I liked it. Bird and I both cried.
Exactly. Like, it's not great objectively, but it's sincere. Like, he really wants you to feel these emotions. He really wants you to see these things and to hear these things and to hear this music. And it really does feel like someone trying to show you something very personal to them. And like, whether you find it cheesy or not, it's like a little kid showing you, you know, their diary. Like, it's beautiful.
Yeah, I agree. I think this movie, for me, I mean, it worked. I felt things watching this movie. I got invested in stuff. I laughed my ass off. I laughed my ass off indeed. In fact, I laughed my ass off so long and so hard that this episode got too long to put out as one part. So, stay tuned in the next couple of days. Part two will drop. Can you believe we talked about Elizabethtown for so long that I had to split the episode? Listeners, give it a shot. Rainy day, feeling blue? Take it for a spin. Next time, we will get into Rusty's Learning to Listen Part 8. Maybe the best movie within a movie cameo thing you've ever seen in your life. It made me laugh until I almost pissed my pants. All right, I'm going to get out of here. I'm just over-caffeinated because chocolate-covered espresso beans are the shit. As always, much love. All the thanks to everybody who heads on over to patreon.com/quillandfilm, QUILLANDFILM. Helps me keep the lights on, keep the hosting fees paid, keep Connor Sweeney and Herbal Tea and myself up to the buzzing eyeballs in chocolate-covered espresso beans. To all of my wonderful patrons, thank you so much. A special shout-out to Deborah Himes, Cassandra Crost. Again, thank you for being my special guest on this episode and for doing this series with me. Stian Bö, David Breda, Mariah Rosado, Baloney Shoes, Leslie Ty, Jeffrey Tiberius Morgan. I miss you, man. Let's get together soon. William Rockwood, if there is such a person. Carl Hartley, Casey Scheibe, and John Scheibe. I have to go run some hills or just run and be free in the wild or drive with the windows down and no destination in mind or, I don't know, drink some water, maybe take a Valium. I'll catch you all next time. Thank you so much for listening. I love you. Goodbye.